On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other fine publications. Our guest today is Heather Wilson, the CEO of Clara Analytics and one of the industry's foremost data and AI leaders. Looking forward to talking with you, Heather. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Peter, for having me.
Yeah. Well, this is a great topic. But first, if you don't mind, could you let us know where you're from originally and how this all happened?
Sure. I'm from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. I grew up what was a small town.
Get out of here. That's awesome. I've been out there many times. I used to live in Fairfax, Virginia for 30 years.
So. Yeah, it's about an hour west of Northern Virginia. So I grew up in Winchester, Virginia. It was very
great
small
town
when I grew up. And I'd say it's a medium town now, but it hasn't lost its small town feel. And I'm just very blessed to have been raised in Winchester.
Yeah. You know, this is it's so interesting. I love that town. I like going to craft breweries. There's a ton out there. Also, the school, the Shenandoah, what is it? University of Shenandoah?
Yes, actually, I went to school to Shenandoah University.
That's great. That thing has really expanded in the town with it.
Yes,
like a lot of towns,
yes.
You know, when they have like a school.
It has. It's amazing.
Yeah.
When I went there, it obviously wasn't you know, as large and as diverse as it is now. And I really have so much gratitude to the Shenandoah University. I wasn't going to attend there. And the then president, who became one of my mentors early in life as a late teenager, and early 20-year-old, when I told him, listen, I'm going to be an international business major, and I'm not going to sit in Winchester to learn international business. I want to be multilingual. I want to go study abroad. I want to do internships abroad. I want to be an entrepreneur all by the time I graduate. And he said, Heather, we will work with you. And that he did. And he taught me so much. Ended up being a Rotary Scholar and studying in Japan, then getting an invite to Gorbachev and Mayor Popov's university, and then being student government president. And he just taught me so much. You know, I would go to trustee dinners with him and lunches, and he taught me how to influence, and he taught me about capital planning and strategic planning. And it really set me, you know, on the right course. And I had done so many internships that I was the first student to have an offer from Anderson Consulting back before it was called Accenture. And it really just gave me a beautiful foundation to launch into an amazing career that I've had.
That's great. Yeah. I want to really get into more of that, how it all came to be. But allow me one more Winchester story, okay?
Sure. Let me give you kind of two quick ones. So when I was 8 years old, I was one of the top Girl Scout cookies sellers. Mm-hmm. And so much so, I was selling in my elementary school that I missed my bus. And the principal...
Oh my gosh.
Had to take me to my mother, who was a teacher, to her workplace. And he just laughed and said, you know, this is probably foreshadow for Heather's life. And that was exactly true. And then I think a second fun story about me and really back to Dr. Davis being so open with me. I knew I was going to go study in Russia after I'd just come back from Japan, and I wanted to understand a different type of economy. Russia was just getting ready to, impeach Yeltsin, gone from communism to capitalism, and I wanted to experience that. But I wanted to be student government president too, so he allowed me to be the first student to run for student government president from Russia. And I had a great staff back on campus. And so when I returned, I was student government president. So
that's cool.
So some, yes, just really great supporters. And the trustees, then many of them became, you know, mentors for me early in life. The founder of Trex, the founder of American Woodmark, you know, Bill Brandt, Andrew Ferrari, all of them just really, and I became the youngest trustee to go on to the Shenandoah board. So just so much love and gratitude back to Winchester and Shenandoah University from me.
Yeah, it goes to show you, like, sometimes, you know, a smaller school, a lot of people may not have heard of that school, is a place you can really shine, you know, and sometimes you can get lost in a big school and you might not have those personal relationships that you were able to develop. So, but I was going to tell you one more Winchester story.
Please.
So love going to wine country. So we're out in, we were out in Sonoma on Railroad Avenue in Santa Rosa is this restaurant called Omelette Express. They're open, I think, for breakfast and lunch. They have the best breakfast. So first time I went in, there's a guy hanging outside with a leather jacket on, like a real cool leather jacket and a hat, mm-hmm. like a cowboy hat. And it turns out he was like I thought it was like the guy seating people because it gets packed. But he was like the owner. And so I started chatting with him and he goes, "Where are you from?" I said, "Virginia." "Oh, well, I'm from Virginia. Where are you from? What town?" "Fairfax." "Oh, how about you?" "Winchester." I said, "Get out of here, Winchester." And I think he ran for mayor of Santa Rosa. But it was so cool to chat with him about Winchester because he was there probably when you were there, if I had a guess, roughly. Before it became kind of bougie, you know,
exactly.
The growth's amazing.
It is.
For any listeners out there, it's a great place to go if you want to like a good beachhead to get to like Skyline Drive and other cool parts of lots of great hikes around there. And but it's a beautiful town. So anyway.
And in the first weekend of May, there's always the amazing Apple Blossom Festival. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
make a trek out and try it out. It's an amazing experience.
So when you travel the world, like I've been around, I've been to Japan, I haven't been to Russia. You just realize like how you just learn by getting away from what everybody thinks America is like the center of the universe. I mean, there's a lot that it is, but also you learn a lot more. You realize how dumb you are when you travel around the world. You don't really know that much. And so how did all of that experience affect how you look at not just the world, but your own like personal leadership style? And what did you bring home with you and how is it influencing what you do now?
Sure. It was a wonderful experience to have at such a young age. You know, a lot of people sometimes don't have that opportunity to be a Rotary Scholar. And, you know, I was there over a year and a half. I went early. I stayed late. I never came home. Did internships while I was there as well. As a Rotary Scholar, you had to be fluent in the language so that you could deliver speeches across the country to the Rotary clubs. So I had a lot of advantages, I'd say, that even other exchange students didn't have. I think my worldview changed very quickly at a young age. So I was 19 when I went to Japan. And, you know, with my linguistic skills and because I had worked in those corporations, it already opened up opportunities for me. So when I was at Anderson Consulting, they sent me back to Tokyo to do some consulting engagements. I could really help in a different way besides my business consulting skills. The linguistic skills obviously helped quite a bit to any American partner that was working in Japan. And then when I also worked for Citigroup and AIG, both of those gave me opportunities to go back and to spend time in both of those markets with consumers and with the staff and really bring, you know, really harmony and camaraderie from the, you know, home headquarters to the Tokyo and Osaka offices, respectfully, during those times. So it really had already opened up so many opportunities long before I knew they would, as I grew as an executive. And even when I was at Kaiser Permanente, you know, trying to save lives with an amazing chairman and CEO through data and analytics, I would travel to Hawaii, where Mr. Kaiser had opened up quite a few clinics. And obviously, you know, a lot of native Japanese had either settled there or were tourists. And so in many ways, I could also help on that in that Hawaii business, too. So it did throughout my course of my career from 19, you know, for several decades. It really did have many doors open for me.
Yeah. So, you know, did your early experience with Girl Scouts get you interested in data? Like, did you keep a really cool Excel spreadsheet in grade school? How did that all happen? Where you got involved in the whole world of tech and insurtech?
Right. So my first chapter of my career was, you know, Anderson Consulting and Deloitte, and I'm really glad I spent my first decade in consulting, because you really learn how to listen. You learn, you know, all the different type of interesting situations clients are going through. You really get visibility to so many different functions, and you're working with clients to come up with solutions. And it's such a rewarding first part of, you know, of my career. And I remember that I was working at a client, and it was in the financial services vertical, and I was just mesmerized. And, you know, I already had a knack for languages and for being able to code as well. So, you know, data was a language to me. And when I could see them using statistics and using coding to be able to understand their customers, both in a financial sense and a marketing sense, how to be able to communicate with them because they had such different views on their customers, how to segment them. And this was, you know, let's just say this was back 21 years ago, and it wasn't in the most sophisticated technique. And, but the way that they were able to have those views just mesmerized me. And I had an epiphany, and that epiphany was, this is the future. And this is not just for financial services, but this is something that's going to be important for every industry out there. So I had the opportunity to work and go from consulting into industry to Kaiser Permanente. And it was so fulfilling to be able to work with, he became one of my mentors. It was George Halverson, the former chairman and CEO of Kaiser Permanente, a vertically integrated organization, which meant, you know, he owned his real estate, he owned his medical facilities, he owned his pharmacies, he owned his radiology. And, you know, it was a provider and a payer model. And George had, you know, the thesis that through data and through ways of mining the data and putting an analytical lens to it, we could save lives. And that was during a time, and this was 2006, 2007, where, you know, five chronic conditions were really hurting the U.S. population. And once you got one chronic condition, you were pretty much, you know, on the verge of getting the trajectory of maybe the chronic condition two and chronic condition three. And he really had this mission that through data and analytics, we could find those members that before they even got the first condition, that we could reverse care and get them back to health where they didn't even get, let's just say, diabetes as the first condition, then coronary, you know, artery disease and hypertension after that. And so it was so fulfilling for me to work for him and to work for that organization. And this is before, you know, they had roles called chief data officers. I mean, we were just information officers, information strategists at that point. And so not only did I lead that for him, but I also led the innovation. And so being able to work side by side with, you know, medical professionals to find innovative ways to have people do physical therapy, or building, you know, operating rooms of the future, you know, building robots, or building robots that can carry supplies throughout a hospital to take the load off of nurses. It was an extremely rewarding time for me to start in healthcare, to try to save lives and try to better lives through many of the innovations, and working with those medical professionals was amazing. And then the second part in working with George is, at that point in my career, I really felt a passion about working with women in technology, working with women in STEM. And George was the first one to step up to be a sponsor for it as the chairman and CEO. And that was through his own mother had had, you know, difficulty being a technician in the library field and wanting to digitize early in her career and really feeling like she wasn't empowered to do that. So he really helped to launch Women in Technology at Kaiser and so many other women with me. And that was very rewarding for me as well.
Yeah. Listening to you talk, Heather, it's so interesting how all these people came into your life they were mentors, but you strike me as the kind of person who was very open to learning. And if you ask questions and align with people who can steer you in directions, like, that's when you start to learn. A lot of people feel like if I ask the question, they're going to think I'm dumb, you know?
Right.
And you can't learn that way. And there's a lot of people at the top, and I've met a lot of them in my career, that who have all the answers. They ask questions, but they already know what their answer is.
Yes.
And I just don't think they're going to be as effective if you're willing to be a little more vulnerable.
I totally agree with you, Peter. And that's been one of my, I'd say one of my mantras in life. I think a leader is both a learner and a listener. And I think sometimes we lose those two attributes. And I remember when I was on the board, my first public board at Equifax, and one of the board members asked me to be on a new committee. And I said, why would you want me on that committee? And he said, because you ask so many questions. You're so curious, but you do it in such a way that the team feels like you're on their side and you're trying to help them. And so I would say as a young executive, I was always, you know, so curious. And, you know, when I went to Kaiser Permanente, those medical professionals knew. You know, I hadn't gone to medical school. I hadn't gone to, any sense of a strong, you know, science background beyond, you know, what you do in for a bachelor's degree for business. But, you know, I was curious and I learned from them, and I could wrangle the data and learn how to work with them all of the vital data is coming in for people's, you know, vitals and all the other data coming in on their medical records. You know, we really worked together and learned how to translate with each other. And so, you know, I've worked in four different industries, and, you know, and some of them I'd never worked in before, but I learned, I worked in the hospitals and I followed, you know, patients as they would come in and through the process and the workflow. And being curious, being a listener, being what Michelangelo says, being a lifelong learner. And it's something that I emphasize as a mother too, to my twin sons, that listening and learning are just as important as the times that you need to lead too.
Yeah. Very interesting. So you're in an industry, healthcare, that obviously has purpose. And yes. Insurance does too, a different take on it. So tell us now about Clara Analytics. Your mission, your target customer. What is the better world that you envision for your customers if you're successful with what you're doing for them?
Right. So I think a lot of people think that, you know, my time of being the chief data officer at AIG was really the catalyst for me becoming the CEO of Claire Analytics. And I would say a little bit of yes, but, you know, I also had some time in working with, you know, a large retailer, large logistics, supply chain environment as well. And in that instance, they were a self-insured corporation. And that meant that, you know, there's a chief risk officer that really worked with a third-party administrator when it came to all the claims that they were dealing with. So workers' compensation claims, so an injured worker, injured employee on the site, or it could have been a, you know, a driver, employee that was having a bodily injury from an auto liability center or a general liability sense. And I really watched how that respective chief risk officer really didn't have the visibility after first notice of loss of what was happening with the employees, other than really receiving a report from the third party administrator. This is, you know, where your injuries, you know, where they are, you know, these are probably going to go to litigation. You know, these are, you know, in this particular phase of where they are and receiving treatments. And here are the providers they're seeing. And I felt like there could be a better model out there. So when I was given the opportunity to become the CEO of Claire Analytics, you know, what we're trying to do is, after first notice of loss with a bodily injury case and a workers' compensation sense or an auto liability or general liability, we're trying to get that employee, that claimant back to health as soon as we can. And so our platform has learned over the last decade millions and millions of these cases. So our models have learned and learned how these cases, right? So someone's, you know, hurt their knee badly in a distribution center. We're getting the case. We've seen that 100,000 times all over the US, and we know the perfect treatment for that case. We know how much you should reserve for that case. We know how long that case is going to take to get them better. We know how much the predicted cost should be. Our models are constantly working on behalf of that employee, on behalf of that claimant, to get them the right treatment, the right provider, making sure the right medication, the right procedures, making sure that, you know, if we sense that they're getting upset with the situation, they don't go into litigation. Our models are reading every piece of medical bill, every piece of legal bill that's coming in on that case in every form possible. We read the notes that the adjuster is, you know, talking about with the case. And so, you know, we provide the cliff notes, we provide the explainability, we provide, here are the next best reasoning on this case to think about how to take this case with that employee. So it's really a mission. And it's also outcomes. We're delivering outcomes for the self-insured corporation, for the carrier. So they're getting financial outcome, and then they're getting outcomes for that claimant that they're getting the best treatment possible.
Okay. So So tell us more, if you just can, and this is not a show about tech per se, there's plenty of podcasters who do that, but I'm just curious you mentioned your models, how are you deploying AI in what you do?
Sure. So we have machine learning models that learn all of these cases, and they're built in cohorts. So when a case comes in, we know it's anonymized, but then we know it belongs with this cohort because it's a particular bodily injury part, okay? Then the models then go into a predictive analytic state. So then we're predicting what the reserving, what the cost, what the treatment path should be. The models are then predicting propensity, you know, propensity of you may want to settle at this range. We may be sensing there's litigation, okay? And then there's Gen AI. And the Gen AI piece of it is, you know, using several large language models where we're summarizing. We're summarizing the case. Think about the Cliff Notes. I grew up in a time when you use Cliff Notes quite a bit. So if an adjuster has 100, 200 cases and they're receiving a predicted alert that something may happen, they're being triggered to go into the case, they're getting the Cliff Notes. This is what's happened. This is what happened the last 90 days. This is the whole Cliff Notes of the case to reorient them back to it. Then a big part of our platform too, through a user interface, is every document on that case, we're summarizing, right? But not just summarizing, we're also providing some, you know, outliers, alerts that we're seeing on these documents that then go back to how we're triaging a case. So we're triaging a case every day using every piece of data or predictive models, or, you know, sending off alerts and triggers on the cases. And it's all through a visualization of a portal and a user interface that our clients log into every morning.
Okay. You know, it's just a crazy world out there with what's happening with AI, generally speaking, in the business and consumer worlds. And there's a lot of fear about how the human being will continue to play a role. So how do you see it? How do you see it, Heather? Will there be a human being involved ultimately in claims?
How do you see it playing out? I think that the claims process is just going to get better and better for people. I think the human is going to work on different tasks as the automation gets better of taking over many of those tasks. So maybe the report is generated by the automated model. The automated model is telling the adjuster that think about A, B, or C going forward. Which route do you want to take on this? You're giving multiple choices. Maybe a script is already developed for the adjuster instead of them having to write everything. So I think that the adjuster's load, which is very, very task-oriented, heavy administrative, I think we'll see more and more automation in the workflow take over those pieces. Then I think the models will continue to augment and provide a second set of eyes, a second set of decision support in front of the adjuster, because the models will be able to put together more of the data points of correlations and patterns and outliers than a human can process or, you know, humanly put together. And so I think that, you know, there will be an even better augmentation of intelligence. And then the adjuster really can spend time with the claimant and really give them that empathy, give them that, you know, emotional piece. And I think it's sometimes hard for them to do that because they're overloaded with those tasks that the automated models can take. And everyone is working on this. They really are. And I think as they gain more and more trust in the augmentation part of it, where the adjusters trust it, the chief claims officers trust the outputs and the reasoning of the models on the potential paths going forward on the case, then I think we'll continue to see more and more adoption on that part. So we're going to keep on chipping away at what these, you know, overly worked adjusters have on a daily basis.
Yeah, they are absolutely stressed out. And that's not even... That's just normal without even a catastrophe. Like a natural catastrophe or something. I know that's not in the space you're in necessarily, is it? I mean, you're more on the liability side.
More on the bodily injury.
Yeah. Right? Okay.
Yeah. So but my, still, right?
Something
happens to somebody. I mean, we've all experienced it, right? In a personal or commercial sense, bad things happen. And that's why you have a claim. That's why you have insurance. And so that point of experience, it's just so important that we chip away at their task load and at their cognitive load and really get them on this other place at some point. Everybody's working at it. You know, it's hard with legacy environments. Everybody's working with their core systems. Everyone's, you know, trying to figure out how to put in, you know, different utilities from an automation piece. They're trying to figure out where do they want to, you know, plug in some of the decision support from a from an AI perspective and agentic. You know, it's still though comes down to that quality and integrity of the data. You know, for us, because we do read all the written notes of adjusters, we get the story there. We really do. But I know that we still have a lot of carriers that deal with, you know, just entry of data into core systems. So that free form data and text form in those notes are just, they're the gold for us.
Yeah. That's again, getting back to the human side of it. My daughter, one of my daughters is a gerontologist. She has her master's in gerontology, which for those who don't know, is the study of old people. And I've told her I'm patient number one. But I bring this up because when you said the adjuster can really spend time with the patient, I think that is what my daughter said about like the future of healthcare for the elderly, in the sense that right now everybody's stressed out, like cleaning bedpans, taking people to the bathroom. There's no socialization. And this is what the elderly crave, especially if they're alone, which most are in those places.
That's right.
And she, her thing is, everything's going to be, all that other stuff be done by robots. And then people can actually spend time with humans.
That's right. Yeah. Not only for robotic processes, but in that sense, right? And the, you know, whether it's in those nursing homes or in the healthcare environment, the more, and everyone's working on this too, right? Getting those robots to carry things, getting those robots to help lift things, help, you know, take people to places. I think, you know, we're absolutely going to see that over the next decade.
Yeah. Well, you're also, and there's so many parallels to this. The insurance industry is just inundated with workflows that seem like, it seems like the world that, so for example, if you're an independent agent or broker, like there's this workflows processing, claims, sometimes claims handling, but it's just a lot of workflows that are really inefficient. It's getting better, but they're efficient at being inefficient, I like to say. And they think it's their world, when in fact, what the customer really needs, or the prospect, they need time. They need to talk with people. These insurance people are super smart. They're professional. They've gotten, a lot of them have degrees and certifications. They know what they're doing from a risk management standpoint, but they just don't have the time. They're going on processing, then the next sale, and then processing. And it's, I feel like AI is going to really help elevate the role of insurance professionals, not just claims adjusters, everybody who can spend time with, whether it's B2B or the end consumer. Not really a question, Heather, but you know.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple of points too for us to make it easier for them as well is, you know, it's hard. So many of the organizations they've got to free their data and really get this data at a good place, because without that, it's putting more task on these claims handlers, right? Because if you think about it, it's very fragmented. And when you have five different players that they are in this workflow, okay, and claims data alone, you know, there could be a broker, there could be a TPA, there could be a core system, right? And then, you know, then you've got an AI platform like me. I mean, you know, for us, there could be four or five different players, you know, surrounding this core data. And to orchestrate that is across that workflow to make it really efficient is really still something that is a big, you know, an inhibitor for really seeing what we can do with AI and all the capabilities. And that's also going to play a part on customer experience too. It really still for me comes down to, you know, if they don't have that data at their fingertips, right, it's very difficult for them to give the best customer experience. And then they're back to doing all the tasks, right? And the way they have to do the task is still very much, a lot of times, sometimes manual, right? And so it's still really heavy for them.
Yeah. So You mentioned earlier about learning and listening in leadership. If you were going to mentor others, I'm sure you are, but if you were going to mentor others about, you know, they're looking to be in leadership as well, what do you tell them?
Yeah, I usually tell people, you know, I work with a lot of college students and then people right out of college too. And I've told them many times, listen, you're just going to have to do some of this grunt work and be scrappy, no matter what size of organization that you join. Okay. You're going to have to learn the details, right? Your work ethic. You're going to have to really show up and be the eager beaver. Okay. You're really going to have to be the learner, the listener. And then at times when you have the opportunity to be the leader, to be the collaborator, I really emphasize that to those, you know, early, the graduates that are just starting their career. Obviously, AI is really making knowledge to graduates on their fingertips, right? As before, it was a little bit harder, but I think it's taking the experience curve and squashing it just a little bit. But at the end of the day, you know, that knowledge, that experience, it all comes down to, you know, are you an eager beaver? Are you going to have that strong work ethic? Are you going to be detailed and scrappy at times? Are you going to, you know, make sure that, you know, you're signing up for sometimes going the extra mile, signing up for more? It's just, you know, if that's where you want to be, then that's how you have to show up. I've told many times attitude is just so worth it. You know, attitude.
I could not agree with you more. I find, and those, a lot of that, what you said there are the soft skills, and assuming that people have the hard skills and
exactly.
You know, they're smart enough, they've listened and they've learned in school on the hard skill front, you know, they can put a sentence together, they can write code, they can, you know, master AI, whatever it is, but all that other stuff is really critical. I like what you said about being scrappy at times. I think it may just be that the Generation Z, which is the big, you know, one coming into the workforce now, age like 13 to 30, I think, last I checked, it's a big generation. I don't know whether we did that to them with the snow plowing the way for their careers to unfold perfectly before them. But, you know, life is not really a straight line of progression, and you can't always have the perfect job out of school or even the second or third job out of school. You do have to be able to do or willing to do the grunt work. I totally am in alignment with you on that, Heather, because I think that's kind of missing a lot. The expectations, there's a lot of pressure on these kids to do well, especially if they're trying to pay the rent and buy a car and so forth.
Yeah, you know, I know for me, you know, I'm part of the Gen X, and, you know, many of my mentors, you know, some of them, you know, Don Callahan, who was the CEO of Citigroup, you know, I was in my mid-30s and he took a chance on me, right? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. First female chief data officer in my mid-30s. And, you know, I remember asking him later in life when I caught up with him, and he was just like, Heather, you just had this, you know, attitude, and, you know, you would go out and you were patient, and you also would go out and collaborate with people. And, you know, I just knew you were the candidate for this role, but you listened to people and then you knew how to bring them together, but then you had the technical skills. And if you didn't know the technical skills, you learned them and you sat down. And he's like, you just displayed all of those attributes to me, you know, in your mid-30s. And, you know, some of my mentors are from the silent generation. And, you mm-hmm. know, Arthur Martinez, the former CEO of Sears, right? When I was getting ready to take my first board role, you know, he was just like, Heather, you know, you have to listen. You have to, you know, be able to, you know, show up this way. And I just really appreciated him, you know, just guiding me through that. And then Siri Marshall, who was the, you know, general counsel, you know, first female at General Mills, just coming in and, helped molding me as a board member. And, you know, it was different from being an executive and making sure that, you know, I knew my role in that situation. That wasn't, they knew I had the technical skills. They knew I was curious, but how to be a first public board member. So, yeah, I think that if you're patient, if you have that, you know, that attitude, it's going to pay off. But, you know, sometimes, like you said, it may go right before it goes straight. I'm going to say with that is, you know, you may not get that promotion when you think you should, but there's going to be something that's going to happen for you. And whoever got that promotion, you're happy for them. They deserve it. And then your time is going to come. But people are going to be watching you. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the gen I've done quite a bit of reading and presentations around the generations and another line of work I'm in, and I'm just Gen X is a very fascinating generation in the sense that there's so many things that listening to you talk I could have predicted that you're Gen X, hard working.
Right.
It's a very hard working generation and didn't get the credit. You know, I'm not saying you didn't, because I want to play name drop bingo when you're, you know, all these people who have you've interacted with. It's incredible. You've been all over the world. You've met so many CEOs, and they must have seen something in you. It's very cool, Heather. But I wanted to get into more about the family stuff. And you mentioned in past profiles something called mom time zone. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And you mentioned you're a mom of twins. Talk a little bit about that, because when I was, I'm not the silent generation. I'm a younger boomer, but I remember a world where women were essentially like not allowed to talk about or just really be a mom, and they had to hide it. It was absolutely ridiculous, because it was all about the work. Butts in the seats, don't leave early, take your kid to the doctor. It was kind of sad. And thank goodness those days are over. But it's still that unpaid work that goes into being a mom. It's just, it's an astonishing amount of physical energy and emotional energy. I don't know how you guys do it. And then have all the paid work.
Right.
So, how? Tell us how you did it. How are you doing it?
No, exactly. You know, I think it's the best job ever. It's the hardest job ever, being a mom. And, you know, I had some of the huge highlights of my career, you know, when I started at Citigroup when my twins were born. I had just left Kaiser Permanente. And, you know, somehow I was promoted, you know, when the boys were even, you know, within their first year. I think I just never stopped. I never slept. And, you know, thank goodness they just need to feel your warmth and your love and stability in that sense. And I think that for me, you know, as I've grown as a mom and as the boys have gone through their phases, you know, there's not a balance. There's really times when I just have to say and put on my calendar, I'm going to this, and then I'll come back and I'll probably put in 4 hours later that night at work, you know, or that weekend, you know, if I'm taking Friday because I need to go to this for them, then I'm making sure on the weekend, you know, I'm very transparent with the team, always been very open with any of my, you know, immediate bosses, and they've all been very supportive. Obviously, I've seen the ease over the last 25 years of my life. My boys are 15. So, you know, I've seen the ease on us being able to have a little bit more of that flexibility. And I tell my team, listen, there's deposits and there's withdrawals. Okay. I make deposits and then I'm making withdrawals when I need to be with my sons. Obviously, through middle school, right, there's a lot of identity. They're trying to figure themselves out. And then now that we're in high school, you know, I just love being with them, because they're forming so much more because they're going deeper. They're going deeper in their leadership, who they are. They're going deeper in the organizations that they're joining. They're going deeper in their sports. They're going deeper in their thinking and their academics. They're starting to think about next in other areas of their life. And I'm just really fortunate that the board at Clara gives me the flexibility that I need to do my withdrawals and do my deposits, and that, being committed to both. And listen, look at the Olympics that we just have. There's some amazing mothers that we just watched as well, and how the commitment to being a mom and being an amazing athlete and being gold medalist and medalist. It does. It takes a lot out of us being moms and CEOs, but we make it happen. And I'm very open with my children too. So when I have to go on a trip, I talk about where I'm going. I'm talking about the purpose, right? I try not to spend more than two nights away. And I have a very, a great executive team around me, very supportive if something comes up. So it really does take a village. And my boys go to a great school. It's a village. They, very supportive. So, that's the way it has to work. Just a really good support system all around.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Kids are like wild animals. You have to train them. You have to put the time in. Otherwise they will haunt you mercilessly the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So people, and all the problems in the world, you look at people who are struggling with drugs or with crime, or just, they just can't seem to get out of this vortex. A lot of times it's just, they didn't have at least one parent. I'm not telling you something you don't already know, but it just continues to be. And think about if I was female commuting to the World Trade Center back in the 80s, like I was doing, hour and a half each way, 3 hours a day, 15 hours a week, just to get to and from. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine if I had a raised kids. Our two girls, I don't know how we would have done it.
Right.
If my wife wasn't there, and she worked part-time too. So that's really an awesome story. Those boys are off to the races.
Yeah.
Great to see.
Love them to pieces and enjoy every moment I have with them.
Yeah. All right. Let me, before you go, ask one more question, if you don't mind. What's a myth about the insurance industry that drives you crazy?
Yeah, so everyone always talks about, so slow to adopt, so slow to, take on new ideas. And, I find that insurance executives are right there with other industries, right? They're in their labs trying new things. They're out there looking at different solutions. It's not that they don't want to and they're not trying. I think that all of them are just really trying to figure out, with many of the environments that they inherited, what types of ways can they work solutions to get them in workflows. So it's not disjointed. It's not a horrible experience for an internal user or an external user. I think that, yes, it's a risk averse industry with what we do, but I think everyone is really trying to, move the needle forward and trying to streamline their processes, automate their processes. They know the work that has to be done. It's just a big ball of, upstream processors and data environments that they're just trying to navigate and be very thoughtful with, end users and that experience. So I think it is a myth. Like, they're so slow, insurance. I think insurance is very thoughtful. They're very methodical. They know we're in a highly regulated, but they're innovating, mm-hmm. They're innovating and they're trying to figure it out.
Well, Heather, thank you. I agree with you there. And everything you've said, just a great conversation. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thanks, Peter.
I'm sure we'll see you at one of these InsurTech conferences.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the time.
Take care.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.